While we wait for latecomers to trickle in, let me do a little bit of housekeeping with my students in the FDA colloquium. Response papers are going to be due October 15th. See how nice I am? So don't tell me that Brink interfered with that response paper. Guidelines are on the website, so it behooves you to look at those before you actually start writing. In 2 weeks, so that's October 18th, we have our next lecture in this series. That will feature William Hubbard, who is former Deputy Commissioner for Policy. He is now Senior Advisor to the FDA Coalition. He's going to be speaking on some of the legislation that was just passed in September, PDUFA, for those of you who remember from our first session, and actually focusing largely on issues involving importing drugs and food. So that's the same time, 2 weeks from today. The week after that, we have Mike Taylor, and you should remember also Deputy Commissioner, and we'll talk more about that in 2 weeks. I think that we will get started. Okay. Let me introduce first our two speakers today, and then I'll set up the ground rules for how this is going to work. Now you've got to come down here. I'm going to start with the one I like to think of as the petitioner here, since that's indeed what you are, Scott. Scott was actually, despite my youthful looks and his youthful looks as well, my student quite a while ago, probably one of my best students I have ever had. And he won both of my awards, and I really don't think he was trying very hard. But the good news is he then went off and won everybody else's awards as well. He then went and clerked for Clifford Wallace in the Ninth Circuit, what I like to think of as his houseboat career. And from there went to Justice Scalia and clerked there for a year. Following his clerkship on the court, he then joined the Antitrust Division at DOJ and worked on US v. Microsoft. He then joined Latham & Watkins in 1999 and throughout his tenure there has worked on appellate and Supreme Court litigation. Students of mine in LRW will fondly remember his hard work in Rutter v. Bollinger, which we use as a sample of wonderful brief craft. And yes, we do indeed. Scott began the representation of Abigail Alliance and Fink with the D.C. Circuit. And he is here, not necessarily representing Abigail Elias, but certainly of those viewpoints in this context. Rich Cooper, who we'll think of as the respondent, although he can play many roles in this one, is a graduate of the Harvard Law School. He was president of the Harvard Law Review there. He then clerked for Justice Brennan. As I learned this afternoon, spent a fascinating year after that in Uganda trying to make law, but Idi Amin came in. And he succeeded Dick Merrill as chief counsel of the FDA in 1977. Those of you in my FDA class should have noticed that he was on the brief in the United States v. Rutherford for the government. He joined Williams & Connolly. He is considered by everyone as one of the top FDA lawyers in the country. I might argue that he is probably one of the top lawyers in the country generally. He has taught food and drug law at Georgetown, written extensively on food and drug law, and has served on myriad advisory committees. And we are very lucky to have both of you today, so thank you. Now, to set up the ground rules of how this will go, let me tell you a little bit of background since not everyone has had the same materials. And then what we're going to do is have Scott talk for about 15 minutes. Responding will be Rich Cooper. But I do want to emphasize to all of you please ask questions as they come to you, even while they're speaking. Think of this as an oral argument. We'll give Scott lots of practice for this. So blurt it out. Feel free to speak as you will as the question comes to mind. And after that, we will go through some additional questions, some of which I hope that our students have thought of, some generally from the audience, and some that I can't wait to pose as well. So as the publicity for this event should describe well, this case actually comes out of a very heart-wrenching story, and it actually has a strong UVA connection. Abigail Burroughs was a 21-year-old UVA student who was diagnosed with head and neck cancer. After she had exhausted all the standard treatment for head and neck cancer, she applied to be in a clinical trial for a drug that was still not yet approved called Erbitux. She was denied access to that trial, and she died soon after. Her father, Frank Burroughs, after her death, formed the Abigail Alliance for greater access to developmental drugs. And the Abigail Alliance filed an action in District Court of D.C. in 2003, alleging that FDA regulations limiting access to drugs in the developmental stage violated substantive due process. The district court dismissed that case for failure to state a claim, stating that it lacked authority to state a new fundamental way. Then Scott comes into the case. A divided D.C. Circuit panel ruled that there was indeed a fundamental right based on Glucksberg, and following that, the en banc D.C. Circuit said that there was not a fundamental right. And that's where we stand right now. Scott filed the cert petition, was it Thursday? Friday. And we are sort of waiting on tenterhooks to see what will happen with this case. So I'm going to slide over there and leave it to both of you. My view is that you stay relaxed where you are. There are microphones right there if they can't hear you, but if they can, I think that'll make it a, hopefully, make you want to ask more questions.
Can everybody hear me? Okay, great. So my client's claim is that at least if you are terminally ill and have exhausted all of the approved treatment alternatives, and your doctor wants to prescribe for you a drug that is currently in phase 2 or phase 3 clinical trials, so this is something that the FDA has approved for substantial human testing, not approved for general marketing, but for substantial human testing, that you ought to have a fundamental right under the due process clause to make the basic risk-benefit balance decision for yourself, rather than to have to come to FDA and convince the FDA that the benefits are likely to outweigh the risks of that thing for you. Now, this is a substantive due process unenumerated rights claim. A lot of people think that substantive due process is a bit of an oxymoron. It is, but only in a superficially textual sense. The due process clause comes from the law of the land clause in the Magna Carta. It has had a substantive element forever. If you didn't believe that the due process clause has substantive implications for the content of legislation, then you wouldn't think that the First Amendment applies to the states, and you wouldn't think that the Equal Protection Clause applies to the federal government, because the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, and the Equal Protection Clause only applies to the states. The court has incorporated the First Amendment against the states and reverse incorporated the Equal Protection Clause against the federal government via the substantive component of the due process clause. So no really serious person anymore thinks that there's no substantive component to the clause. And so the court has been really grappling for 150 years with what substantive liberty does the due process clause protect. The easy category are the enumerated rights and the Bill of Rights, things explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. But there has also always been a category of unenumerated fundamental rights that the court has recognized under the due process clause. They include, for instance, the right to send your child to the private school, even if the state would prefer to force everyone into public schools. The right to teach your child a foreign language, even if the state would prefer to ban, for instance, the teaching of German. The state actually tried to do that. The right to live under the same roof with members of your extended family, even if the state would prefer to pass zoning laws that say you can only live with your immediate family members. You have an unenumerated fundamental right to live in the same house with your grandma. You have an unenumerated fundamental right to marry whoever you want, to view pornography in the privacy of your own home, although some people think it's a medical decision. These doctrines all bleed together. And more recently and famously, you have unenumerated fundamental rights to use contraceptive devices that the state would prefer to ban and to abort the pre-viable fetus. Now, the sort of conventional legal zeitgeist is that the category of unenumerated fundamental rights slammed shut after Roe versus Wade in 1973 because the backlash against Roe has been so extreme that it has provoked a more general sense in the entire legal profession, and particularly the federal judiciary now, that the whole enterprise of unenumerated fundamental rights is really suspect and ought to be treated with enormous caution, if not disdain. So, you know, anytime you advocate for a unenumerated fundamental right that the Supreme Court has not already recognized, you're sort of immediately branded as crazy. The court hasn't recognized a new one in a long time, with the arguable exception of Lawrence versus Texas, but that's a complicated case we talked about too. Our claim is that the right of at least a terminally ill patient with no other options to direct the course of their own medical treatment within these narrow bounds deserves to be on that list. And although these cases are always very controversial in the aftermath of Roe, we think that this one ought not to be as controversial as it has been, and isn't nearly as radical as it might first appear, either as a matter of medical policy or constitutional law. So let me say a few words up front about the health policy and then get to the things that I actually know anything about constitutional law. The FDA's principal defense in this case has been that we have a federal policy that people shouldn't take drugs unless and until they have been thoroughly tested by scientifically rigorous clinical trials and shown to be safe and effective. That sounds like a noble and sensible policy, but if you push on it, there's actually a remarkable number of holes in that supposed policy under present law. For instance, we think the clinical trials that are being conducted for these very same drugs are ethical and that the patients can give informed consent to the trials. So anything that's in phase two trials, for the most part, somewhere in the neighborhood of several hundred people, are being allowed by the government to make this exact same choice that we're advocating patients ought to be allowed to make. Off-label use. It remains the law, despite all of the amendments to the FDCA, that if a drug is approved for anything, a doctor can prescribe it for anything that doctor thinks is justified by the scientific evidence, constrained by really nothing other than that individual doctor's judgment. So there is an interesting irony, actually, in the fact that the 1962 amendments to the FDCA that really create this whole issue, the advocacy amendment, that gave the FDA for the first time the right to deny patients access to a drug purely on the ground that it hasn't been proven effective. We're really motivated entirely by the thalidomide tragedy in Europe, which is a horrible tragedy. A morning sickness drug called thalidomide turned out to cause terrible birth defects. Actually, it was not a major public health crisis in the United States, thank goodness, but it was really awful in Europe. This produced a public outcry that gave the FDA greatly expanded powers. Interestingly, it may surprise some of you in the room, though, to know that thalidomide is now prescribed all the time. It's prescribed for cancer. And in fact, it until very, very recently, was not even approved for cancer. It was approved for leprosy. Many years after the problem with its use as a morning sickness drug, it was tested in the United States and approved for a very limited indication for leprosy. individual doctors then began theorizing and experimenting with its possible uses of treatment for cancer. It's actually quite effective at certain stages for certain cancers, and was prescribed for a decade or more, widely for cancer. Under circumstances where it had not been subject to rigorous clinical testing for safety and efficacy at all in this country, nonetheless, was perfectly legal. Treatment IND. The FDA itself recognizes that it would be irrational and cruel to deny access to drugs that are still in clinical trials in all circumstances to terminally ill patients, because, of course, those patients are going to die before the ordinary run of the clinical trial process can be finished. And so the FDA has baked into its own regulations what, at least on the surface, appears to be a fairly generous standard for the approval of terminally ill patients who don't have other options taking investigational drugs that are still in trial. The FDA recently actually filed a proposal for some regulatory reform that and said in the Code of Federal Regulations that, in its view, to support expanded access for an individual patient when the patient has an immediately life-threatening condition that is not responsive to available therapy, ordinarily completed phase one safety testing in humans at doses similar to those to be used in the treatment use, together with preliminary evidence suggesting possible effectiveness, would be sufficient to support such a use. So essentially, our claim, FDA has said in the CFR that they think that phase one data is ordinarily enough. Indeed, they said that in some cases, there may be no relevant clinical experience, and the case for potential benefit may be based on preclinical data or merely on the mechanism of action. Little, if any, clinical evidence to suggest a potential benefit, or possibly only animal data to support safety. FDA also has a policy, which taught me this earlier this week, actually, of non-enforcement with regard to the possession of investigational drugs for your own use. As long as they're only for your own use. So you can fly to France, and actually one of my Abigail Ryan's clients did this for several years to take Aloxetine before it was approved in the United States. You can fly to France or anywhere else, get a quantity of drug that is unapproved in the United States that is sufficient to treat yourself, bring it back, and FDA will not object to treatment, your doctor treating you with that compound. So the supposed general policy that we don't allow people in this country to take drugs until they have been proven safe and effective by rigorous clinical trials isn't quite all that it's cracked up to be. Now, on the law, the basic issue in the Abigail Hines case at this point is really standard of review, and I'll acknowledge it at the outset that this is cheating a little bit because, as we all know, standard of review is often the whole game of constitutional law. What we're fighting about right now is whether the right standard for evaluating FDA restrictions interfering with patient access in these kinds of circumstances is the rational basis test, or it can set something more rigorous, like strict scrutiny, narrowly tailored to a compelling state interest. Unfortunately, the court has painted itself into a little bit of a corner by framing constitutional law in those terms. It has been for some time generally true that if the court decides that rational basis applies, the law is automatically upheld. And if the court decides that strict scrutiny applies, the law has a very hard time surviving. The court has been trying, I think pretty clearly, to claw itself out of that hole over the last few years. In cases like Lawrence versus Texas, that at least on its face purports to be applying rational basis review, but nonetheless strikes down the law. Or a case like my favorite, Ritter versus Bollinger, finds that, in fact, the interests of classroom diversity are compelling enough to overcome strict scrutiny in what is probably the most restrictive context, racial discrimination by the government, that is known to constitutional law. But nonetheless, it is generally true that the standard review is important. Our view is that the standard can be rational. And there are a lot of different ways to approach these questions. The court said in Washington versus Glucksberg that the right way to identify whether fundamental rights are at stake is to ask whether the right is implicit in the concept of order and liberty and deeply rooted in the traditions and conscience of our people, We all know that that's a little bit of a fraud because that's not what the court did in Lawrence, and it's not what the court did in Roe, and it's not what the court has done in a lot of other cases. But nonetheless, that's sort of what they are saying recently about the most restrictive way to approach these cases. So we have approached it on those terms. So how does our claim shake out? Well, if you're going to analyze whether the right of a terminally ill patient with no other options to direct the course of their own medical treatment is implicit in the concept of order of liberty, I think you have to start with the sort of gravity of the autonomy interests that are at stake here. These are, without question, I think, one of the most private, personal, and important decisions that any individual is ever going to make in their life. How a person chooses to face the prospect of imminent death is, to my way of thinking, far more profoundly personal and important and central to their autonomy and ability to define themselves as a human being than a lot of the decisions that the Supreme Court has recognized as implicating fundamental rights like contraception, abortion, whether you send your child to private or public school. Justice Stevens had a passage in his concurrence in Washington versus Glassberg that I really like. Says that respecting individual choice and end-of-life decisions gives proper recognition to the individual's interest in choosing a final chapter that accords with her life story rather than one that demeans her values and poisons memories of her. I think there's something to that. Set aside autonomy, though, and just think about the rights of life that is protected along with liberty in the plain text of the Due Process Clause. It has to mean something. And these are clearly life or death decisions. The FDA's favorite practical argument in opposition to our case is that if we significantly expand access to investigational drugs, the consequence will be that some patients will be dissuaded from signing up for clinical trials. The American Society of Clinical Oncology actually filed an amicus brief in our case at the in-bank stage, at which they said, look, the problem here is that Abigail Alliance is advocating for greater access for the terminally ill to phase two and phase three trial drugs, but the patients for whom they purport to be advocating, terminally ill patients with no other options, are the perfect candidates for phase one trials. And if we allow them access to drugs that are currently in phase two or phase three, who's going to sign up for a phase one trial? Well, boy, I mean, that may or may not be ethical. I don't think it is. It may or may not be persuasive as a policy matter. But if you think about, if that's how you're analyzing this problem, if what is at stake is weighing the private medical treatments of individuals against a system that we have set up that we think is necessary and important in protecting the future progress of science, then surely the right standard for assessing the individual's interest in that circumstance isn't the rational basis test. It's got to be strict scrutiny or something close to it. Another way to approach this issue is to think about the other rights the Supreme Court has recognized. As I noted, I think this is at least as compelling as the right to marry, decide where your kids are going to go to school, decide whether you want to teach your child German. You can also usefully compare this situation to the other rights that the Supreme Court has recognized in a purely medical context. Griswold versus Connecticut recognizes a right of access to a medical product that the state of Connecticut preferred to ban, contraception. It did so, actually. The background of Griswold that a lot of people have kind of lost track of is that that case and that issue was largely driven by doctors who were very concerned that their married patients, who women who had some significant health risk associated with getting pregnant, were being put to a very difficult choice between abstaining from marital sexual relations and violating a state law that banned contraception. The Supreme Court said that contraceptive situation implicates fundamental rights. It talked a lot about the privacy of the marital bedroom, but there was a health risk issue lurking in the background. That lurches to the fore in Roe versus Wade, obviously, and all of the Supreme Court's abortion cases from Roe forward. The Supreme Court has recognized a right to abortion up to the first or third trimester, now viability, as a matter of reproductive autonomy and privacy. But a separate right to abortion at any point throughout pregnancy, if it's necessary and appropriate medical judgment to protect the life or health of the woman. The Supreme Court had a case a few years ago called Stenberg versus Carhart, where the state of Nebraska tried to ban a particular abortion procedure, some colloquially known as partial birth abortion, although doctors don't call it that. Nebraska, the state of Nebraska thought that that procedure was morally problematic, but they also made an explicit finding that it's riskier than other procedures that were available to doctors in that same circumstance, and that no medical studies or clinical trials established the safety of the partial birth procedure. And so they banned it. The Supreme Court got that case and acknowledged the, quote, division of opinion among some medical experts and the absence of controlled medical studies that would help answer these difficult medical questions. But the Supreme Court nonetheless held that since, quote, doctors often differ in their estimation of comparative health risks and appropriate treatment, the state must tolerate responsible differences of medical opinion. So, therefore, the law is that no abortion statute can interfere with the private medical judgment of an individual doctor and patient in a life-threatening situation. If the treatment that the doctor happens to want to prescribe, it happens to be abortion. But how can it possibly be the law that a woman dying on the on an operating table has a fundamental right under the Due Process Clause to trust her own doctor's medical judgment, even in responsible medical judgment at least, even in circumstances where the state might disagree, only if the procedure her doctor thinks she needs will involve the incidental destruction of the human fetus? It makes no sense. Now, the Supreme Court decided a case last term called Gonzalez versus Carhart. I imagine we'll talk about it a little bit later. The critical point, I think, is that the Supreme Court reached a different conclusion in Gonzalez than it reached in Stenberg. But Congress had made a finding in the federal partial birth abortion statute that under no circumstances was that procedure ever medically necessary. The court unanimously acknowledged that if the federal statute posed a significant health risk to any woman, it would be unconstitutional. And it held open the possibility of as-applied challenges to that law if an individual woman could come into, or doctor could come into court and demonstrate that under particular circumstances Congress was wrong, and the banning of that procedure would actually create a substantial health risk to a particular woman. Think also about the Cruzan case. Supreme Court has recognized a fundamental right to refuse all medical treatment and die, even nutrition and hydration, even for a relatively healthy person. If you have a fundamental right to refuse all medical treatment, including nutrition and hydration, and die, why in the world don't you have a right to choose to take some risks with your life in a good faith effort to save? Second half of the, and I see I've already run about as long as time as I care to take up, the second half of the Glucksberg analysis is that a new constitutional unenumerated right under the Due Process Clause has to be deeply rooted in historical tradition. look, this is what you would call a tradition of non-regulation case, right? There is a spectrum of what history tells us about potential unenumerated rights, ranging from, on the one end, things that were clearly prohibited at common law, like assisted suicide. The Supreme Court considered in Glucksberg, assisted suicide was always criminal at common law. It's very hard to say that a right to assisted suicide is deeply rooted in historical tradition when it was against the law. On the other end of the spectrum, you have a handful of things that were subject to affirmative protection at common law before anybody really started thinking about constitutional rights. That is a very narrow and limited category of things. It probably includes the, critically for this case, I think, the right to introduce self-defense evidence in a criminal trial. But it's a very limited category of things. And then in the middle, you have a broad range of conduct that was the subject of the vast arena of freedom at common law in the 18th and 19th centuries that are things that the state just never presumed to try to interfere with. The now recognized right to send your kid to school wherever you want, teach your child a foreign language, marry whoever you want. There was no affirmative protection at common law for any of these things. It simply fell within the broad sphere of liberty that legislatures wouldn't have dreamed of interfering with prior to the 20th century. And the question is, how, for purposes of whether a right is deeply rooted in historical tradition, how do you analyze cases like this one and those? We think the right answer is you look for analogies. You look, the Supreme Court looked in Cruzan to the common law battery and drew out of that an analogy that you have a right to reject unwanted intrusions into your body. Our view is that the common law rights to self-defense and the common law defense of necessity and the traditional common law tort of interference with rescue all reflect a broader common law tradition of protecting the general right to self-preservation. The framers called self-preservation the first law of nature. What all of these doctrines had in common was a general principle that people were privileged at common law to violate ordinary legal rules in life-threatening circumstances if their life was at stake. We think that's at least as good an analogy for the right that we're claiming as battery was for the right the court recognized in Cruzan. I think I'll rest there because I've already seen my mind. So I
red line.
Yeah.
One of the absolute joys of being a lawyer is that every once in a while you get to hear somebody as talented as that. I want to start with two.
We're inviting questions.
Yes, go right ahead. I once was in the Supreme Court, and the lawyer got his first question when he was about here on his way to the lecture.
You mentioned a couple of exemptions where the FDA for terminally ill patients will allow them to use it, generally their compassionate use application. Why was that not available to Abigail's?
Well, Abigail's individual circumstance is really complicated. We can spend a lot of time talking to about it. The short answer is that M-Clone was a complete mess. They were in, way out of their league. They didn't have the manufacturing capacity to make enough of the drug to make it available for substantial compassionate use, even if the FDA had been so inclined. Now, if my clients were here, they would give you a very complicated explanation about how that was FDA's fault for failing to approve the manufacturing facilities that M-Clone had in the pipeline and wanted to bring online, but weren't allowed to. But I don't think it would be productive to argue it out.
Scott mentioned the Abigail case. I want to mention two other cases, both real cases. One is a friend of mine whose wife has an inoperable brain tumor and who is living with this issue now. So this is not an abstract issue. This is an issue that could affect anyone in this room at some point in your life. And that can affect me, affect Scott, any of us. Could affect any member of Congress, any person employed at the FDA. And that's an important fact about this situation, this issue that I shall return to. The second case is one that occurred in the late 1970s when I was at FDA. There was a child named Chad Green who lived with his parents in Massachusetts. He was about 7 years old, as I recall. He had a leukemia, but a treatable form of leukemia with very high 5-year survival, which is, I believe, for oncologists, the practical equivalent of a cure. He underwent chemotherapy. His parents were appalled at the side effects of the chemotherapy. They took him to Mexico, where he was treated with Laetril, a quack cancer remedy, and he died. And the case received national attention. The Abigail Alliance is not arguing for Laetril. They're not arguing for that kind of situation. But again, I think it is a salutary case to keep in mind as we discuss this issue. How many Chad Greens would you prepare, as a member of this society, would you prepare to see die a year if this right were recognized in absolute terms? What is at issue here is not whether terminally ill patients or seriously ill patients should have access to unapproved investigational drugs outside clinical trials. There is some access now, as the questioner noted. FDA has conducted a Federal Register proceeding in which they are proposing to, as a practical matter, make the right more actual for people, make it easier for people to access such drugs. Scott and I could spend a lot of time discussing the precise conditions under which that right should be defined, how it should be defined. But that the issue is not whether people should have access. The issue is whether there should be a constitutional right to access. What turns on the answer to that question is whether the contours of the access right should be defined by judges and justices, or should be defined by the political branches, by the Congress, statutory law, by the Food and Drug Administration, whose commissioner is subject to appointment by the president, nomination by the president, and confirmation by the Senate. Let's look for a moment at the different procedures that the courts have as compared to what the political branches have to address a question like this. If there is a constitutional right, then it gets application of that right ultimately gets decided in court in a procedure that involves the presentation of evidence, examination and cross-examination of witnesses, introduction of documentary evidence, possibly the participation of a jury, possibly not, possibly amicus briefs, but the proceedings are controlled by a lawyer for a plaintiff and a lawyer for the defendant. And then judges get to decide, and their appeals, and petitions for certiorari possible. If the political branch is decided, what you have is a proposal in the Federal Register in which anybody, any organization, any individual can respond to by submitting a comment. I don't know how many comments went in on the FDA's December 2006 Federal Register proposal on access to investigational drugs. I do know that when FDA conducted a Federal Register proceeding on the proposal to make Plan B, the morning after contraceptive, available over the counter rather than only by prescription, it received 47,000 comments from the public. That's pretty broad public participation. FDA would then issue a final rule, and FDA's final rule would be subject to judicial review under the lenient Administrative Procedure Act standards. But as a practical matter, FDA's policy decision would be subject to review by the Congress in congressional oversight or by new legislation, in which the entire political process could be involved. In addition to conducting a Federal Register proceeding, FDA has, over in the past and could again, conduct hearings around the country at which people could actually come and speak to FDA decision makers. The decision makers, by the way, would not be people in black robes, but would more likely be people who, at least at some point in their career, have worn white lab coats. A lot of people with MD and PhD after their names, subject again to their political superiors. Commissioner of FDA historically has almost always been an MD. Not always, but most of them have been MDs. So those are the procedures. And as you think about this issue, think about which procedures are more in tune with our societal way of dealing with these issues. The text of the Constitution answer this question? I think it does not. Either way, is there established jurisprudence that answers this question? I think it does not. You can make arguments. Their arguments can be made on both sides. But we're in an area of the law, substantive due process, where there is very little hard law. There are moods, there are attitudes, there are preferences, predilections. There are no legal formulas. What's really at stake in an issue like this is whether the courts, or the Supreme Court in particular, is prepared to say that this is an issue in which the political process in this country has failed, and we're going to take it over because there's no prospect for it being addressed successfully or appropriately. Scott can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe every one of the cases he alluded to as creating substantive due process rights involved state law rather than federal law. All or nearly all of the history of substantive due process has been the application by the Supreme Court of the United States of federal law against an errant state. And in virtually all of those cases, it was arguable, at least, that the state was in some way out of touch with a national consensus that had emerged on an issue that people think was important. But substantive due process, I think, is about, fundamentally, is human rights, almost in a worldwide sense. Is this something that we're prepared to call a human right, the right to marry, the right to raise your children, the right to control the reproductive aspect of your life? We're dealing with certain kinds of human rights, in that area. And is the issue that's presented here one in which the political branches of government have failed and that there's no reason to believe that they can address it appropriately? In most of the cases, if not all of them, that Scott had mentioned, there was some reason to believe that the political process not only had, at the state level, had not only failed, but would not correct itself because of prejudice, because of moral blindness, because the aggrieved group was a minority of some kind that couldn't get a fair shake in the political process. Whereas here, as I pointed out at the beginning, this issue could affect all of us. It's not just the people who are terminally ill now. How do we want our society to be organized when we have the brain tumor? When one of our children is at the end of what orthodox medicine can offer? How do we want that issue to be set up for us when we don't have a whole lot of time to deal with it? And what I suggest is that this is an issue on which the political process is working. A statute was enacted in 1997, Section 561 of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, 21 U.S.C. 360 DDD, I think it is, that prescribes standards, criteria, for access to investigational drugs outside of clinical trials on a treatment basis. FDA is engaged in rulemaking. It issued a Federal Register proposal, which Scott quoted from in December 2006. And the very fact that he was able to quote from it approvingly is an argument, at least, that the political process is en route to delivering something like what he wants without the courts taking it away from him. If FDA's response time is too slow, FDA says in the Federal Register document they're willing to take a request over the phone. You don't have to submit mountains of paper. You can make a phone call if it's an emergency situation and there isn't time to gather the paper. But if they don't handle the phone calls adequately, there is redress in the Congress if enough people care about it and can get a member of Congress interested and get a hearing set. But that'll focus the attention of the Commissioner of FDA if he has to show up at a hearing and defend what his agency has done or has failed to do. So I submit to you that in this democratic country, we should take issues away from the political branches only when we're pretty well sure that they fail. Whenever the Supreme Court declares a statute or an act of the executive branch unconstitutional, the Supreme Court is in effect saying the political branches have failed. We accept that from our Supreme Court. That's a consequence of judicial review established early in the Republic. When the Supreme Court does it under the Due Process Clause, however, it's doing it without a strong textual basis. If it does it in this area, it's doing it without a strong jurisprudential basis. And it has to make the judgment whether this is an appropriate case to declare that the political process is fair. The fact that this involves the federal government, not a state, is a quite, I think, quite significant aspect of this case. The Wall Street Journal, not the greatest champion of unenumerated constitutional rights, devoted devoted two large chunks of its op-ed page to support the pieces supporting the Abigail Alliance. What is going on here? This is perhaps an opening wedge in an attack on the 20th century's created regulatory state, created by, from the, in the Progressive Era, when the first food and drug law was enacted, broadened under the New Deal, when the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938 was enacted. I think that's what attracts the attention of the Wall Street Journal to this. And what Scott and I talked about this the first time we met, be my parting shot. What looms over this case is the shadow of Lochner against New York. State of New York set a maximum work week for bakers of not more than 10 hours a day or 60 hours a week. Mr. Lochner permitted his employees to work more than that, challenged the statute, and the Supreme Court said the statute was unconstitutional. Justice Holmes, in dissent, said the following. In part, a constitution is not intended to embody a particular economic theory, whether of paternalism and the organic relation of the citizen to the state, or of laissez-faire. It is made for people of fundamentally differing views, and the accident of our finding certain opinions natural and familiar or novel and even shocking ought not to conclude our judgment upon the question whether statutes embodying them conflict with the Constitution. If you believe in paternalism, it's not in the Constitution. If you believe in libertarianism, it's not in the Constitution. Go advance your cause in the political process.
Almost like there should be drum rolls. Questions from the audience.
Do you have a rebuttal?
Yeah. Well, you know. You know, to some extent, you know, rebuttal is different, difficult because Rich and I have very different views of the, you know, the nature of the Constitution. You know, the hearing you talk, it's a very structuralist social choice kind of approach to constitutional interpretation than, you know, the whether or not something is protected by the Constitution depends on whether the political process is really able to address it in a good and meaningful way, or has addressed it in a meaningful way. Now, I guess I'm just sort of much more of a formalist. That, you know, I think that there are some issues that the Constitution just places beyond the legitimate purview of majoritarian interference, whether or not we think the majority would do a good job or not. They're just so important to individual freedom that they're the sorts of things that individuals ought to get to decide for themselves. You know, with that said, I do think that there is a little bit of a social choice breakdown operating here. And, you know, I don't know if this is too far, but nobody expects to be terminally ill and have no other options. We, as a country, have a dramatic national tendency to avert our eyes from death or serious sickness. Nobody wants to think about the possibility that they will ever become seriously ill. And when someone does become seriously ill, we have a tendency to stop thinking of them as people and start thinking of them as a public health problem or, you know, a problem to be solved. And the category of people for whom, you know, we are advocating are terminally ill patients with no other options. It's a situation that nobody ever thinks they're going to find themselves in. And when they do find themselves in that situation, they're only there for a brief period of time because they're terminally ill and they have no treatment options. And they don't really have any realistic opportunity for political mobilization. There is an interesting exception to that phenomenon that I think is really telling, and it's HIV. We did, for a period in the last decade, have one terminal illness that did possess all of the social choice preconditions for effective political mobilization. A terminal illness, but nonetheless one that took an awful long time to develop, so people had a lot of time to think about it and mobilize politically, and a group of people who had something in common culturally and therefore an easy way to connect with each other and mobilize. And the consequence was that we ended up with a regime for the review of HIV drugs that is very different from the political regime that we have for anything else. It's vastly more liberal. It gives patients access to investigational HIV drugs at a far earlier point than those people would have access to if they had cancer. And I don't know how to explain that other than a difference in the social choice preconditions for mobilization.
Two thoughts. One, Scott's absolutely right. What, the argument I made, I should never put in a legal brief, and no judge or justice would ever put in an opinion. That's one point. Second, I think I would hazard the guess, based on my own experience as a law student, that your legal education is highly, highly court-centered. Most of what you read in law school, I suspect, are judicial materials. Not completely, but mostly. And one leaves law school, particularly if you're thinking about clerking, focused on the courts and not on the other legal institutions, the other lawmaking institutions in our society. What I thought was the best course I had in law school, I gather is no longer taught, was a course called Legal Process, in which you saw the courts, and you saw legislatures, and you saw executive branches, and lawyers and law offices, and trade associations, and all kinds of other institutions in society, all of which together created the law that actually was brought to bear on people. Scott gave the example of HIV drugs. Very interesting example from this perspective, that where we are today on HIV drugs compared to where we were when the disease was first recognized is a function of the interaction of lots of institutions in our society, scientific institutions, drug companies, the government, NIH. The medical armamentarium that exists at any one time is a social product. Part of it, we in fact turn it over to private companies who market the products. But the system that creates the products is a function of scientific education, of medical education, of the actual online experience of doctors and treating patients and what they need, and what works and what doesn't work, but also the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and the standards for review that FDA has developed, particularly under the impetus of the 1962 amendments, which Scott referred to in his opening remarks. And so when an individual patient claims an absolute right to have access, the access that that person is seeking is made possible by a social product in our country. And there is, we have, as a society, through our laws, through our democratically elected political figures, have chosen to have a system of regulation which has fostered the development of these products for our benefit. And in deciding what absolute rights we have, for example, to opt out of clinical trials, to bypass clinical trials, we have to bear in mind the function of those clinical trials in providing the products, the medical products on which we all depend, which are a social good.
That's fair. Let me make one more observation about this sort of the institutional competence point. I mean, I think this is really very important, and it has to do to some extent with why we have structured our claim as narrowly and carefully as we have, and you know, the charge has been leveled that we gerrymandered it so narrowly that it doesn't sound like a fundamental right anymore. Terminally ill, no other options, phase two or phase three drug. And a part of the reason for that was to focus the litigation on the question that I think, anyway, judges are competent to resolve. You know, we have structured the claim in such a way that the FDA and the political branches are still making the scientific judgment about whether the evidence of safety and possible efficacy is sufficient to permit expanded substantial human clinical testing, to make those trials ethical, to allow a patient to give informed consent to the trials. At that point, to my way of thinking, the question of whether you would let an individual patient who can't get into the trials make the risk-benefit judgment for themselves to take that same risk isn't so much a scientific judgment as a values judgment, the question of the line between paternalism and autonomy. And that is the sort of question that constitutional law is meant for.
Mark?
For Mr. Ballinger, assuming cert is granted and then you go on and win, what rule...
That's a great one.
What FDA rule, in your opinion, would be narrowly tailored for what I presume is the compelling state interest of safety? And how far would that rule be from where it appears the FDA is moving right now?
Well, I think that that actually the regulatory change necessary to give us what we want in this litigation is astonishingly narrow. There is a provision of the regs 312.34B. It's the treatment IND reg. Yeah, that's right. It authorizes treatment IND outside of clinical trials if the drug is intended to treat a serious or immediately life-threatening disease. No problem with that. If there is no comparable or satisfactory alternative drug or other therapy available to treat that stage of the disease, no problem with that. The drug is under investigation in a controlled clinical trial, fine. The sponsor of the clinical trial is actively pursuing marketing approval, that's fine too. The portion of the regulations that bothers us is 312.34B3, in which the FDA reserves the right to deny access to the drug in its own sole judgment, even if all of the above things are true, and even if you're terminally ill and have no other approved treatment options. If in its sole judgment the available scientific evidence does not provide a reasonable basis for concluding that the drug may be effective for its intended use in the intended patient population, or that it would not expose patients to an unreasonable and significant additional risk of illness or injury. Our view is that if the FDA is simultaneously deciding that the phase 2 and phase 3 trials are ethical and that a patient can give informed consent to the trial, that the patient has a fundamental autonomy right to decide for themselves that basic risk-benefit judgment. That's really it. To some extent, I think that's about all that constitutional law can accomplish here. My clients have a vastly more complex and, to some extent, aggressive in the sense of moving additional law, the present law, in additional directions. Legislative proposal that would be more expansive. But I don't see ultimately the courts, for instance, recognizing a right to take drugs that haven't been approved as safe in clinical testing. That would involve, I think, an intrusion by the judiciary into scientific questions that they are going to be enormously reluctant to venture into. But with that said, footnote, it's hard to know what to make of Gonzalez versus Carhart, in which even Justice Kennedy and the majority acknowledged the possibility of an as-applied challenge to the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act, in which Congress made an explicit medical finding that that procedure was gruesome and inhumane and never medically necessary. If the courts are allowed to second guess that, maybe they're bolder than I think.
Several thoughts. One is that the right that's claimed here cannot be limited in the way that Scott has packaged it for this case. If you're talking about an autonomy right, it's not going to be limited to drugs, it's going to apply to medical devices as well as to drugs. It's not going to apply just to people who are, quote, terminal, unquote. It's going to apply to people with serious, very serious, debilitating disease, people on the verge of Alzheimer's disease, people with glaucoma that's about to wipe out their eyesight, and so on. Very hard to limit it. So you're going to cut a wide swath across drug and medical device regulation. And if you're going to enable people to, you can question the ethics of our system of, in effect, channeling people into clinical trials. But if we don't have enough people in clinical trials, we're not going to have the drugs that we want to have for ourselves, our families, and others. Your attitude to how you face the prospect of death is one thing. The technical decision about which drug or device you ought to be taking, I think, is something different. And that's a matter in which patients are going to defer to the judgment of somebody. You're not going to, there are a zillion chemicals out there you could take to treat your cancer, let's say, or whatever other dread disease you have that's about to snuff out your life. But it's not rational to take it unless there's some reason to think it may help you and won't cause you a much more painful and much quicker death than is your prospect. That's all that FDA is saying in its regulation that it's going to require for someone who is facing a life-threatening situation. The ultimate issue here is whether people should be able to reject even that, when our society, through its democratic institutions, has put that into effect. And that's the Chad Green issue. Suppose there are 1,000 Chad Greens a year. You comfortable in such a society? Suppose there are 10,000. How many does it take?
Yeah, of course, that move depends on the prior move of insisting that the limits that we've carefully drawn around the bounds of our claim, you know, one from hand off more to be expected. The claim that we have made is that patients who are terminally ill and have no other approved treatment options have a fundamental right to make this decision for themselves, generally, and other treatment options, all of them, not all of them, so Clayatrol did.
But doctors still prescribe it, including in the United States.
There are, I think, two different kinds of slippery slope arguments buried here, and I think it's useful to disentangle them to some extent. There is a kind of slippery slope argument that the Supreme Court found persuasive in Washington versus Glucksberg in refusing to recognize the right to assisted suicide. It was, if we recognize this narrow, carefully drawn right, and the petitioners in Glucksberg gerrymandered that right about as well as we have, it was very narrowly drawn. The Supreme Court said, you know, even if we recognize this right, it only extends to terminally ill patients who want to commit suicide with the assistance of their doctor, but without their doctor's direct involvement. The doctor wouldn't actually be pulling the trigger, so to speak. We are not confident that doctors will be able to implement those distinctions in the real world in an effective way. And therefore, it's a very good reason not to recognize this right. I think that is a legitimate and powerful set of slippery slope arguments. There is, I think, kicking around in Abigail Alliance a separate set of slippery slope arguments that I find far less compelling. And they are that if we recognize this, you know, carefully drawn constitutional right in these narrow circumstances as compelling, we as the judiciary, as the legal system, are not going to be able to figure out how to distinguish the next case that we find less compelling. We think that this sure seems like a powerful case for a constitutional right, but we can't figure out how to write the opinion that will distinguish that right from a right that would apply to patients who are not terminally ill, who only have patient Alzheimer's, or who have other rights. I actually think it's relatively easy to draw this distinction. Could argue that out. I don't find that set of slippery slope arguments very compelling at all, because I think it's an assault on the legitimacy of the common law method. You know, Justice Harlan's dissent in Poe says that you approach these cases, you draw them narrowly, the right narrowly, and you approach them very carefully on their facts one at a time, precisely because there's a lot of virtue in the common law method of drawing careful distinctions. And you know, if the way that we approach a case like this one is to race ahead to the next six cases that you know, we think aren't going to be compelling, and we can't figure out how to write the opinion in those cases, and so we reject the constitutional claim of somebody who is before us, is dying and has an enormously powerful claim, there's something wrong with our methodology. There's something wrong with the tools of constitutional law at that point.
Well, I think that there is something wrong with the tools of constitutional law with respect to substantive due process. We have the history we have the decisions that we have. We don't have a methodology that actually decides cases.
In this case, is the FDA obligated to provide the justification that this is the criteria that have been met in their best judgment, there is not adequate support for the allowing the use of the drug? And if so, what was their justification?
Well, we're not.
Not
we're not there. Yeah.
But are they?
But I don't think they're not required to write an opinion or something.
They need to say no.
That would be interesting.
The standards they're applying are in the statute. So Congress, in effect, created the standards in 1997, and Congress doesn't have to explain standards it puts in the statute.
But I thought you said that despite these criteria, in the best judgment of the FDA officials, there is not adequate justification.
Yeah, they don't have to write an opinion that we could then attack under the Administrative Procedures Act or something. That would be interesting, but it's not
the way to work. So just focusing on the non-judicial implementation that you thought was a more compelling slippery slope argument, I was just wondering, and this kind of goes to something that Mr. Cooper was saying earlier, why, under the regime that you're proposing, anyone would ever rationally sign up for a phase two trial if they could guarantee themselves the drug by not doing so? Because if you sign for a phase two trial, you might get a placebo. And if that's so, wouldn't there be a big public policy issue?
Well, if you're
in a life-threatening situation, you're not going to get a placebo in a phase two trial.
Okay. And also, we have conceded repeatedly throughout the case that the constitutional right we're arguing for applies only if you have no other alternatives, and that ability to get into a trial counts as another alternative. Now, you know, arguably that's further gerrymandering the right, but another way to come at it is that I think that if you recognize the broader right, and FDA passed a rule that patients are not allowed to give up the possibility of enrolling in a phase two trial if they could get into it in order to get access to the drug outside of the trial, I think that rule would be narrowly tailored to compensate them for some of the investors. My clients were here, they would tell you that the whole reason for the organization's existence and what they really care about is the patients who can't get into the trials. Abigail fought like hell to get into the Ertz trial.
Why not?
Because Inclone chose to focus the phase two trials only on colon cancer patients. It actually tragically turns out that Erbitux is far better treatment for head and neck cancer than for colon cancer, but for largely economic reasons, they chose to focus on.
Well, there's another side aspect of it that really isn't germane to legal issues, is that companies, for a variety of reasons, may be very reluctant to allow compassionate use of their drugs. If they give them to patients who have concurrent problems and so on, they'd be very hard to tease out the outcome in that case. It could affect the ultimate database on which they're seeking approval of their drug. They might face some product liability concerns. Even if they get informed consent, courts may say it's against public policy or something. So there are economic aspects to it as well. Their production capacity may be very limited. So there are other reasons why people might not have the access that they want, quite apart from the law, or at least the part of the law we're talking about.
If substantive due process, to use my intuition, where political process doesn't work, why wouldn't it work in this case?
Why
won't the process solve this?
Well, I mean, I dissent from that framing of the issue, but, you know, I think that it hasn't worked thus far, in part, because the issue is incredibly complicated, and because patients are terminally ill and have no other options, aren't really in a position to politically mobilize and advocate for their interests. And because the Washington spin cycle has been captured by the far sexier and more broad-based opposite problem with a different kind of FDA review. FDA review of drugs for the treatment of common and not life-threatening conditions like heartburn and inflammation that turn out to be dangerous. So, you know, Vioxx, fentanyl, diet drugs. You know, when a drug is approved and it turns out to have adverse medical consequences, there's an enormous political, you know, rush to urge FDA to clamp down on the approval of new drugs. And that political pressure is not terribly discriminating, as it should be, between, you know, two categories of drugs. There ought to be a very different standard applied to drugs that are for life-threatening conditions for which there are currently no effective treatments, and the next copycat drug for heartburn. But the political process has not, at this point, done a terrible good job of distinguishing.
I've got one. Scott, you say that it would take a study with a small change to affect your what you're trying to get, but I would argue it's possibly not so small, in the sense that in a clinical trial, all of the data is either held by the FDA or by the drug companies. And so to make an informed decision, a physician, never mind a patient, would have to have access to that data. Now, I'll grant you, they don't even get access to that data later, but at least FDA has access to that data in full and fair examination. And to actually do it as an informed consent would take a fundamental change in the way we approve drugs in this country.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Of course, we're positing a circumstance in which the FDA has decided that the trial is ethical and people can give informed consent to the trial. And doctors all the time urge their patients to go get into the trial when they don't have access to that internal information if they're not the doctor conducting the trial. So Abigail's oncologist at Johns Hopkins did the research that you could do from public sources. He saw that her cancer had high EGFR receptors and herbicides were specifically targeted to that receptor. He didn't know everything that ImClone or the trial doctors knew, but he knew enough to urge her to go take it. You know, what you're positing is that there is a profound difference between the situation where Abigail is urged to go sign up for the Erbitux trial, and then when she signs up, she's presented a raft of disclosures from the drug company that maybe contain some additional information that her oncologist didn't have, and that you know, somehow makes a powerful difference to informed consent. I'm not sure that it really does. The really critical determination, in my view, is FDA's determination that they can conduct the trial and that patients can, they can ethically conduct the trial and patients can give informed consent to the trial. If that's right, the fact that an individual patient who we would allow to sign up for the trial if they qualified won't have access to the same information that the trial participants have when they ultimately sign the consent form, it doesn't move me all that much.
Does it move you at all?
Yeah. Part of the right that is contended for here that we haven't talked about is not merely the right of access to the patient, but the right of the manufacturer to sell at a profit the drug. So what this would create is a new business in selling investigational drugs before they've been approved to a limited class of potential patients. But nevertheless, for some of the more common fatal diseases, heart disease, cancer, it could be a substantial business. Now, the protection that Scott builds in is that if they've got to be dealing with FDA, they've got to be in an FDA-controlled trial, they've got to have completed phase one. Whether those barriers to quackery remain standing is one concern. But largely until well into the 20th century, the history of medicine was the history of quackery. There was a decision by the Supreme Court in 1902 called American School of Magnetic Healing versus McAnulty, in which the Supreme Court said, in essence, that medicine is like religion. People can believe whatever they want. There's no claim that the Postmaster General refused the mail service to the magnetic school on the ground that it was a fraud. And the court said there can be no fraud in medicine. It's just a matter of opinion, just any more than there can be in religion, just what you believe. Well, that was then. And a long, sad human history is summed up in that. We don't want to go back there.
I have something of an unformulated question, but it draws on the economic issues you just raised. And it seems to me, lurking in these decisions and your arguments is the stakeholder of the individual. So with this whole increasingly complex, increasingly profit-driven industry, making decisions about which science goes forward and which doesn't, and who has access to it. And this complex scientific enterprise, isn't it simple as quackery or not quackery, so to speak, your analogy? You know, and the facts of this case that you've sort of been describing here are the end claim material wasn't available for this person anyway. They made a decision go in one direction, probably because it might be more profitable for that group of patients, not necessarily based on the science. So there's this it's not really a constitutional question in this case about how we solve it. It's a question about what is working underneath this about all of the stakeholders in the system, the scientific enterprise, because it seems like the first time that a stakeholder group is powerless, has tried to sort of come forward and have a seat at the table in the courtroom to say, wait a minute, we have an interest here. Do you have any response to do that?
Well, I think that part of what is going on here, I mean, sort of start at the beginning of your point, is, you know, it's more complicated than, you know, quackery and non-quackery. I mean, part of what is going on here is the onrushing train of personalized medicine, right? We are rapidly entering a world where the old paradigm of nobody knows what a drug does until we very carefully test it in complex and controlled clinical trials. They made an enormous amount of sense in 1940, 1960, 1970, probably 1988. It's starting to not make as much sense anymore, right? So you have science that has raced ahead to the point that it actually understands mechanisms of action at a molecular level. Prior to the point at which any single patient in any clinical trial has gotten anything, and my own view is if I were dying and I had no other treatment options, I do a fair amount of work for my good client Genentech. Those guys are brilliant. I mean, I would take something they cooked up on the basis of computer. you know, they're really, it's amazing the things that people can do now. So I think that that part of what's going on here is you have you know, a variety of stakeholders, including not just patients, but also very innovative private tech companies for whom the old paradigm of drug development and drug testing doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. And you have a very nice example going on right now, a drug called Provenge for prostate cancer. It's an immunotherapy that, you know, I think more or less everyone agrees it's harmless. There's some debate about whether it's effective or not. But the company and its investors have locked on. The FDA denied approval over the objections of its own scientific advisory committee in May. And the patients, prostate cancer patient groups, and the investors in that biotech company have locked arms in a massive protest against the FDA denial of that drug. They had a demonstration in front of the FDA a couple of weeks ago. There's a lawsuit out in Ohio. So part of what's going on is that all the old rules are changing and things are getting all mixed up.
Two quick comments. One, I don't know the circumstances of this particular patient group. Often patient groups are funded by drug companies. The other point, Scott quoted from the FDA regulation, FDA's acknowledgement that it might make sense to make a drug available even before it's been tested in the first human being. So they are in principle at least, open to the possibility of the kind of thing Scott's talking about. And isn't that how we want it to be?
My clients would consider me enormously remiss if I didn't point out at some point in this discussion that the treatment IND process, whereby theoretically a single patient can come to the FDA and seek approval to take a drug outside of the process of clinical trials, is almost completely unused. The FDA has conceded several times in our litigation that 80 people a year or so manage to get access outside of clinical trials to investigational drugs via that mechanism.
And the way to deal with that is a line item appropriation.
And I'm going to let that be the last
word. End up with money.